Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly jolt of libertarian commentary about the non-libertarian news. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, a coffee-slurping Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mankiw Ward. Hi-ho, dwarves.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We are going to take the DeSantis war on Disney, both literally and seriously, here in a moment. But first, even your danged Cadillac health insurance plan does not necessarily pay full freight in the event of a health-related need to be airlifted to a hospital. That's where the Air Medcare Network steps in. When you join the Air Medcare Network, if such an emergency arises, you will not see a bill for air transport when flown by an AMCN provider. This peace of mind for your entire household can be yours, beginning at the low, low price of $85 a year. AMCN providers transport more than 100,000 patients a year. That's like 275 people a day. Listeners to the Roundtable will also receive a gift card from Visa or Amazon worth up to $50 American. Just visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason and use the offer code REASON and start protecting your family ASAP. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay. On Friday, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a presumptive presidential contender in 2024, signed a law dissolving the Reedy Creek Improvement District, a special taxing and services provision authority thing granted to the Disney Corporation back in the 1960s. So that the House of Mouse could run its own zoning and fire departments and such like. The governor, the Republican sponsors, and the many conservatives supporting this move were quite explicit that the motivation was to punish Disney for opposing a recent controversial law that limits the way Florida public school teachers can discuss sexuality to young elementary school students. Here's a quote. "You're a corporation based in Burbank, California, and you're going to marshal your economic might to attack the parents of my state," DeSantis said at the bill signing ceremony. "We view that as a provocation, and we're going to fight back against that." End of the quote. Catherine, there are many possible avenues for discussion, but let's start literally. Regardless of intent, is it not a good idea to remove a special government carve-out for a large corporation?
So yeah, I think there's two ways to kind of dig into this. And one is the way that you just proposed, basically the wonky way, right? Which is like, oh, what do we think about this sort of quasi-governmental authority being handed to a corporation over a very long period for a geographical territory, right? We generally agree that the way we do that thing is via county government or city government. And so this is weird. And maybe we should object to it. I actually, while I am sensitive to the entanglement of corporation and state here, I think that that's always worth being skeptical about. I also like experiments in living. And I was actually chatting with someone at the, it wasn't exactly a Georgetown cocktail party, but like spiritually it was, this weekend. And she was saying she's really mad because the Reedy Creek Improvement District used to be like a fun fact that she could share at parties. Like, hey, did you know Disney kind of has its own government? And of course, part of that is Celebration Florida, a planned community that was once within that district and then got spun out for various reasons. But I think that we do this all the time already. Disney is not actually a special case. Universities often have agreements like this in their host cities or counties. We have, you know, campuses that large corporations sit on, like the Google campus, say, which are essentially run autonomously. And, you know, those districts often show up the surrounding districts. They are often nicer and better policed and better run. Not always. But I think having the opportunity to see alternate ways of living, especially in close quarters with traditionally governed areas, is actually good. Now, I think we're going to talk a little bit more about how independent that district really was. Turned out, you can have that rug pulled out from under you, and that limits the utility and scope of the experimentation that you can then see.
I would also just point out that there's something like 1,800 special tax districts in the state of Florida, and something like 1,288 of them, I believe, is the figure I've seen, are independent, like Disney World's. And no one is talking about eliminating all of these, because no one actually cares about whether or not this particular form of tax policy is a good idea or a bad idea on the merits. It is entirely about punishing Disney.
Nick, I'm going to read you a listener email question, but jumping the line here, but we'll do another one later on in the podcast.
I don't know, Matt. I like to follow the rules.
Okay, good.
By custom or law.
This goes from the listener Q, who doubles as James Bond.
QT, Q as in cutie.
This is a common sentiment, which I'd like you to address, Nick Gillespie, which means you're going to have to listen. So I don't know if that's going to be possible. Here we go.
I'm already. Is today tax day, Matt?
Reason it's a taxation is theft day, Nick, and only until
every day.
That.
Every day is taxation.
At
is
last,
theft day,
right? He admits
Reason
it.
Has expressed. Mother Fletchers, all of you. Reason has expressed concern about DeSantis in Florida going after Disney's special tax privileges. Given that the political left has, for a decade now, used lawfare to harass some random baker in Colorado, why shouldn't there be retaliation from the political right? Why unilaterally disarm? What say you, Nick Gillespie?
Yeah, I don't think it's unilaterally disarming. I'm not a fan of the masterpiece cake, you know, baking case. I don't think that person should be, constantly being harassed for his religious beliefs, which I think are wrong. But in this case, what is going on is, the two counties that the Reedy Creek district is in are going to be on the hook for as much as $1 billion in taxes and bonds and things like that. So, you know, maybe let that sink in a little bit. It's bad governance on the most basic level, Matt, on kind of on the wonky level that Catherine was talking about. And then the fact that it is politically, you know, openly politically motivated over the fact that Disney said that they were against a bill that the government passed. So I think it's a really bad idea. It's not unilateral disarmament. This is also upping the ante. None of this should be happening. And in fact, to talk about special privileges, there were privileges that Disney got. For instance, they were going to be exempted from the equally bad social media law that DeSantis, the Republicans, including DeSantis, put into place, which has been put on hold because it is it runs afoul of the First Amendment. But this is not good. Countries where the government goes after corporations because they don't like what those corporations say, that's not a good country, and it's not a good state. Florida is drawing people. This is the type of stuff that will make it a less, viable alternative to places like California.
It also absolutely astonishes me that DeSantis is straight-facedly suggesting that he is the one who is like victimized by an abuse of power here, that the state is somehow the underdog in this interaction. And it's just completely wild to me. Like, he used the word commandeered also to describe, like, there is one entity here
commandeered-
that has the monopoly on violence in the region, and it's not Disney. Like, I don't mean to like put so fine a point on it, but the very fact that Disney invested in, I actually went and looked at the Reedy Creek Improvement District website, which contains this glorious verbiage. The cooperation and commitment between the Reedy Creek Improvement District and Walt Disney World Company is as strong today as it was when the district was created in 1967. The result is an example of how a working partnership between business and government can be prosperous for both sides. But also,
now look,
Disney
when it was,
can't unilaterally, like, Disney isn't the one that unilaterally pulled the rug out from under, and all Disney did was have an opinion.
And so, I mean, DeSantis' argument is even more ridiculous when you consider that the bill that Disney was opposed to
passed
and became law.
Passed!
So even if you think that this was a form of commandeering, it was a failed form. I do not believe that it is a form of commandeering of the democratic process. But it's also kind of interesting that he uses this language of distorting and destroying democracy. He is turning the left's obsession with democratic process back on them. And in some ways, I think making the point, perhaps inadvertently, almost certainly inadvertently, that a lot of the rhetoric about, you know, about this is like an attack on democracy, right, is actually just these people have political opinions that I don't like.
This is a big dividing line between conservatives and libertarians, I think, or it's you know, to the extent that this is a coalition that has been, you know, kind of in a state of kind of permanent disintegration and kind of reintegration and attempts to do it. But you have actual, you know, conservatives saying explicitly, this is the difference between conservatives and libertarians. Conservatives want the state to be an instrument of specific moral values. And they also are defining anybody who disagrees with that or departs from that as somehow immoral, perverted, grooming, etc. This may work in the short term in some like electoral cases and things like that, but it is a fundamentally terrible way to do politics, especially if you believe in anything like limited government. You don't need the governor of Florida telling you what to think about every goddamn thing and whether or not Pluto, you know, and Goofy are secretly in love with one another, you know, whatever.
Was never really a secret. Catherine, some of the conservatives who are against this are precisely some of the ones who are most often mocked by fellow conservatives, the David Frenches of the world, to whom who will say, you know, this is bad, rule of law, etc. And a pushback against him from conservatives that I've seen is, okay, look, you can use the court system, the legal system to fight back in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, for example. That's 10 years of your life and a bunch of lawyer fees, and you're still going to get harassed. What's wrong with actually using the state to get a quick, if perhaps a little bit messy result, but just sort of to kind of a buzz a fighter jet across the tower of something.
Yeah, across the tower of something. That's
well put, Matt. Well put.
Thank you.
So I think the extremely high level of two wrongs making a right in this discourse is just like mind blowing to me. Like I really. Like we all learned in kindergarten, we learned like some very basic principles about how to evaluate the morality of your actions.
And wait, did we?
That was before we were groomed though, right? That was before grooming became the whole curriculum.
One of the things that we should have picked up is like he started it is not a good reason to do something crappy. And I don't understand why. And it does seem to me that this is a relatively recent development. It's always there. It's always in every conversation because we do have this very natural human impulse, both for kind of revenge or like tit for tat kind of treatment. But also, it really has been elevated to like a higher level. Like people who should be ashamed of themselves for offering just very straight-facedly, they started it type rhetoric are now, you know, now seem unembarrassed to offer that argument. So yeah, is our court system like broken and messy and slow? Uh-huh. Does that mean we should just go, you know, politically nuclear on every outcome that we don't like? No, hard no. Like it's so easy to like think through that and come to that answer unless your brain has been poisoned by tribalism and the culture wars. And unfortunately, I think that's just where a tremendous amount of our politics have ended up at this point. The other piece of this, though, that I feel like it's in every article. Like if you read an article about this contretemps in a mainstream publication, three quarters of the way down, every single article says, this doesn't actually kick in for a while, and we believe, we the writers of this article, we the observers who are quoted in this article, believe that it's not really going to happen. So that's the other thing about this is everybody thinks that this is just the two sides taking their initial negotiating positions, using law, like passing laws to establish initial negotiating positions, and that in the end, something like the Reedy Creek District will be reestablished. It will probably be somewhat curtailed, but, you know, Orange County doesn't want to pay for Disney security. and they don't want to have to raise property taxes, which is what they would have to do in the county probably to do that. So it's not even going to happen. We are currently tearing off our own faces over this stupid culture war issue in which Disney just had an opinion about a law that passed and is now proceeding. And it's not even going to happen. And meanwhile, DeSantis, you know, it will not happen quietly and later. And meanwhile, DeSantis's profile will have been elevated.
It's also, by the way, this, you know, again, one thing that reason should, you know, kind of be proud of, and I think foreground, is libertarians are consistent on this in a way that conservatives and liberals or progressives are not, because you're also now seeing a ton of conservatives talking about getting rid of Citizens United, because Citizens United allowed corporate speech to proceed, whether it's from a union or from Disney or from people who work for a company and bundle things through that. You should be in favor of the Citizens United ruling that liberated speech and restrictions on it in a political context. You should be in favor of the masterpiece Cake Baker doing whatever he wants. You should be in favor of Disney not being punished for wrongthink, you know, by a bullying governor, which is what Ron DeSantis is very quickly turning into. And again, the Republicans are going to win big in the midterms for a variety of reasons. If this is the type of attitude that they're going to start legislating immediately or working on, they may not win big in 2024, because this is not what people want. Reason and libertarians have the right solution here, which is that the government should be, you know, smaller, and it should be helping adjudicate basic things, not how people think and how they live. It should be freeing people up to run their businesses and run their lives the way they want.
Peter,
let's pick up on the DeSantis bit.
I was just going to say that, as with a lot of discussions about Twitter and Facebook, which I think this really resembles, so much of this discourse here is predicated on the idea that Disney is in some sense a public good, right? That because it is large and has some reach, that because it has some cultural power as a creator of entertainment that millions of people consume, it has additional obligations beyond providing services for money, right? And so the assumption here, at least from the right, is that Disney owes them something. This is the subtext of what DeSantis is saying, right? That Disney has an obligation to something beyond its contractual agreements, right? Beyond its ordinary
tax. They need to put Timon and Pumbaa in re-education camps. Come on, that's where this is headed.
No. Disney owes you a day of watching failed actors trot around in Stormtrooper costumes if you pay for a ticket at Disney World. They owe you an Ewan McGregor Obi-Wan series if you subscribe to Disney Plus, and they owe Ewan McGregor a whole bunch of money so that he can pay for his expensive divorce because he's starring in one of their shows. But Disney does not have some overriding obligation to the public beyond doing its business and then doing whatever it wants to do with its money, with its time, with its resources. It doesn't have an obligation to, like, the moral collective of Florida Republicans or to the common good, whatever the hell that is. And so what DeSantis is doing is using the levers of tax policy to punish politically disfavored speech. And what it ends up being is a kind of legal punishment without due process, right? And so to take this back to the Masterpiece Cake Shop question, yes, that might be 10 years of your life, and yes, that might be difficult and frustrating, but the whole point of the system is to give everyone on all sides due process, and to give everyone a fair process that is the same for everyone. And the whole point of what DeSantis is doing here, explicitly stated, is to single Disney out for expressing an opinion about legislation.
And it's going to cost taxpayers, though. That's also the big takeaway. These guys are such idiots that they are, you know, it's not going to cost Disney as much as it's going to cost the people in the two counties that Disney World straddles.
Catherine, let me ask you a question. So there's a tweet from Rich Lowry, and I'm going to advise you to not listen to it. In terms of from a DeSantis's action point of view, but from a overall cultural effect point of view. Okay, we've got that straight now. All right, so here's the tweet. Corporations as institutions have been corrupted, very often through bullying and fear, and there's a chance that the Disney controversy will free them simply to fly planes, sell soda, etc. again, which would be good for these companies and good for the country's cultural health. What say you, Catherine?
People are always trying to argue for some kind of coercion of companies from the perspective that it will be good for the companies. This happens from the left and from the right. Obviously, on the left, it's often with respect to either diversity inclusion or with respect to environmental policies. And, you know, it always strikes me as such a weird argument because it's like, if it's genuinely going to be better for the companies, they don't need to be legally required to do it to get there. And I recognize that in Lowry's case, he's arguing for kind of a network effect, a sort of, you know, everyone has to do it in order for everyone to do it thing. But I also think it's a very weird conclusion, especially for a conservative, but honestly for anyone, to think that what the ideal is a private sector totally devoid of moral or ethical or aesthetic considerations. That's not what I want. I want a world in which, you know, John Mackey does the Whole Foods thing, and also in which, like, Giant exists, and it's, I have no idea what anybody involved in the running of that grocery store thinks about anything. And then I can choose whether I want to go to a grocery store with opinions or not. And, you know, the idea that the perfect world is one in which, you know, no morality or ethics or politics or aesthetics sneaks into our corporate lives is weird. Like, that's not how humans are. I don't think it's an ideal. And I recognize that Lowry and others are mad that the left is kind of winning the culture war in a bunch of these elite institutions. But then, like, give a better culture to win that culture war. Don't try to win it with force or government threats.
There is an interesting wrinkle just in the sense that Bob Chapek, the CEO of Disney, tried to avoid taking a stand on the parental rights and education law that has sometimes been referred to as the Don't Say Gay Bill. And he initially said, we're not going to touch this, basically, and declined to take a stand. And then after outcry from some activists outside of Disney and also from employees, changed his position. And
that thing you're describing sounds messy and difficult, and also like it is an internal governance problem for Disney, not a thing that Ron DeSantis needs to solve for Rich Lowry.
You know, if I may point people to the 2005 Reason debate between Milton Friedman, John Mackey, and T.J. Rogers, titled "Rethinking the Social Responsibility of Business." A lot of people on the conservative side right now are quoting Friedman's early 70s argument that the only proper role of a corporation is to increase shareholder value. It was very much an argument that corporations really shouldn't be doing anything other than increasing profits and then letting the people who earn those profits, either through, you know, working there or through being a shareholder, can spend that money however they want. John Mackey, you know, the doyen of conscious capitalism, you know, has a strong case in that argument, I think, against both Friedman and in a way against T.J. Rogers, who is also somebody who is outspoken in his political beliefs. T.J. Rogers, the former head of Cypress Semiconductor, became famous for telling a bunch of nuns who bought one or two shares in his company and then were trying to commandeer him to follow what they thought would be better employee practice, you know, hiring practices. He told them to go to hell. He was a political actor. And when you look at companies now going on, what Catherine was saying, you know, you have companies privately held or publicly held, Hobby Lobby, Coinbase, Ben and Jerry's, Whole Foods. There's a whole mess of corporations where part of their identity is a sense of politics or ideology and of activism. There's room for all of this, in the landscape, and we should be celebrating that, and we should be attacking politicians who are saying, you know what, I don't like what you're saying as a corporation, so I'm going to find some way to fuck you over. That's a terrible precedent to set. It's bad when it happens now, and it's going to be bad when it happens to, you know, the next liberal or progressive or conservative or paleocon company down the road. The libertarian approach here is the correct one.
So there's the sense of we want neutrality in the corporate sphere and such, but isn't that kind of untrue, or at least it is untrue beyond the borders, in that conservatives, especially, but other people too, some kind of internationalist liberals have a lot of critiques of Disney, of entertainment companies, of Apple, of Elon Musk, who maybe is going to buy Twitter today, for doing too much business in China, for example, right? Like the idea about neutrality is going to be nationalist by definition, is it not? Considering what you have observed with the way people talk about specifically big entertainment and their businesses in China.
Peter?
Yeah, I think that's fair. There has been a lot of criticism. In some cases, I think even totally valid criticism of the way that Disney has operated in China. I mean, they shot Mulan and thanked in a region where there are Uyghur concentration camps, and then thanked some of the officials who are almost certainly involved in running those concentration camps. It looks like in the credits to Mulan. And again, it's somewhat complicated to establish like direct responsibility. I'm not saying Disney is running Uyghur concentration camps. They're participating with a government that is doing some just abjectly awful stuff. Some of the most egregious and wide-scale humanitarian abuses in the world today are happening in China to the Uyghurs. And Disney is saying, you know, look, thanks, folks, for helping us out with this complicated shoot so we could get these pretty mountains in the background. And also because they want to sell to the Chinese market, which is huge for movies. And Disney in particular has just has had a booming business over the past decade or two at the Chinese box office, although that may be changing a little bit in the last year or two. And so I think all of the sort of, like, if you want to criticize Disney for that, that's fine. And if you want to complain that Disney is working with the Chinese government and shouldn't be, I think that's fine. And, you know, like, if you're a commentator and you have opinions about that, go ahead and do that. At the same time, the argument here that Disney should just be increasing value for their shareholders, right? The reason they are working with the Chinese government is because they want to increase value for their shareholders. And that is part of do it right. Like, that is a business strategy to make money. And so if that's what they want people to do, then that's going to end up with Disney working with China and working with other repressive governments. And it's going to end up with Netflix and other corporations, you know, eliminating content in the Middle East when governments ask them to do so. And it's not going to be a sort of, it's not going to be the neutrality that you actually want, because nobody actually seems to want neutrality here. What they want is for other private institutions to do the things that they want them to do without having a stake in those private institutions, right? People don't, like, if you want Disney to do what you want, buy it. Right? Elon Musk was like, I'm mad at Twitter's policies. You
Go
know
buy
what?
It. Go and buy it.
Seriously. Yep. And so he was like, all right, so I'm going to buy it. If you want an entertainment company that reflects your values, start one. You can do it. It has been done. There is, in fact, a company that has produced the Narnia films in particular were produced by Walden Media, which was an effort to put big money behind films that were at least compatible with Christian values. I don't know if they quite were an explicitly Christian company, but they wanted to sell to that market. You know, Mel Gibson financed The Passion because he thought that it was important. Now, he made a ton of money off of it also. That was great. But if, like, these, you know, people are always like, well, you can't start a new Twitter. I mean, someone started TikTok. Someone started Twitter at some point, right? That was the Chinese Communist Party. But someone else could have started TikTok, yeah. Right? Someone else could have started these companies. You know, there have been like a succession of social media companies. There was Friendster, there was MySpace, there was Facebook, then there was Twitter, then there was Instagram, and all of it. Right? It's not like we have entered a steady state in which no new competitors can arise. Many of them will fail, it's true, and it is expensive to start these things up, but it's not impossible. And even if you look at something like Netflix, which sort of got into the streaming business early in an attempt to be the dominant player, thinking, well, look, we will win this war simply by being here first and being here biggest, spending the most. Now they're facing huge, huge competition from HBO Max and Disney Plus, and to a lesser extent, companies like Hulu and Paramount. Well, Hulu is owned by Disney, but you know, Paramount Plus, that sort of thing. Because in fact, it is possible to create competitors, even to very, very large entertainment corporations, and those competitors can do different things.
I think there's. It's always also, Matt, just to make you more aggravated than you already are about this conversation being extended, it's worth going back to the parental responsibility or rights bill that's at the center of this latest kind of flare up in the culture war in Florida. It is not a grooming bill. It does address serious questions about parental rights in education. And when you have school districts that are doing things without parental approval or without even acknowledging and talking with parents about stuff, when you read about school districts where children are living as a different gender and things like that, the numbers are always kind of sketchy and things like that. But there is a legitimate question about how public schools are interacting with parents and how transparent they are about policies that are happening at school. That is so far from the idea that, in Florida schools from K to three, you can't mention that somebody has two, you know, somebody comes from a family with two fathers or that they are gay. That is not grooming. That is fucked up and it's wrong. It's, actual sex ed is already barred in K through three grades in Florida and things like that. This is a moral panic and a hysteria that is being whipped up for political purposes. And we should always be going back to saying, you know what, when you are acknowledging a shift that is legitimate and broad-based in American culture about sexual identity and sexual orientation, that is not the equivalent of being a pedophile. And then we have to punish Disney because Disney says, you know what, we're kind of uncomfortable with the law. It's worth reminding people along all of these kind of moments because it all builds up into something where we're talking about abstract things. It's a lot of stupidity. And once again, the reason perspective and the libertarian perspective on this is not only consistent in all of the various permutations of this argument, it's absolutely fucking right, which is that this is not the role of the government and nobody wants it to be the minute that they recognize they're going to be out of power someday.
All right, we're going to get to the officially branded listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, are you tired of feeling like someone's always watching you on the internet, even when you think you're going all incognito? Well, IPVanish VPN is here to protect your right to privacy and help you stay anonymous online. IPVanish enables you to browse safely without exposing your private information to third parties, whether they be advertisers, ISPs, or hackers. When you use IPVanish on your computer, tablet, phone, or Fire Stick, all of your data is encrypted. That means all your private details, passwords, communications, browsing history, physical location will be completely shielded and without sacrificing your speed. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. It really is that simple. Roundtable listeners who act now will receive an incredible 70% off their yearly plan, all with a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's like getting 9 months for free. Just go to ipvanish.com/roundtable, use the promotional code Roundtable, and take your privacy back right now. That's ipvanish.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, please email your queries to the gang at roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Colin in Hamburg. Guten Tag, Colin. And though it's too long to read in full, it's about Colin's mounting frustrations with freedom-hating COVID restrictions in Germany. Live in a free country, Colin. He goes on and on and on, then gets to the nubbin, which is, I'm wondering when it becomes ethical and even required under one's belief in liberty to begin enacting civil disobedience. In this case, I was thinking about riding the U-Bahn, maskless, as a 40-something man publicly disobeying the most visible of the restrictions. might invite others to question the wisdom of the policy. It's relatively low risk, as I'm triple vaxxed, as is 75% of Hamburg, so I wouldn't be unnecessarily risking others' health, and they can wear a mask anyway. It's also like a 40 euro fine, but I'd be willing to eat that cost for the statement of principle. I acknowledge that state power is strongest in a time of emergency, but we're 2 years in at this point and have had vaccines for almost a year, and I realize that I could cause myself visa headaches. But aside from that, is there any ethical reason not to begin a personal campaign of civil disobedience if I object strongly enough to the rules that look like they'll never go away, or at least that the people in charge hope will never go away? Catherine, this is an Ask a Libertarian Ethicist question. What say you?
As asked, I think the answer to the question is no, there is no reason for you not to do the thing. That he is asking about his own behavior, which he's already cogently outlined what the potential costs could be, both to himself and to others, and what he thinks the benefits are. Sounds like he's made a good case for not wearing his mask on the U-Bahn. But this question got me thinking about a conversation that we had a few weeks back with respect to Russians in Russia who know that the special operation in Ukraine is not a special operation, but in fact an invasion, an unconscionable invasion. And there was this idea, you may recall, that somehow imposing quite severe sanctions, maybe one of the ways that that was going to work out was that the people would rise up and oppose Putin, potentially thus overthrowing him and ending the invasion. And that I was troubled by Americans acting as if that civil disobedience was morally required or that it should be expected. The whole point about civil disobedience is that it imposes costs on the person who is being disobedient. We consider it heroic when it is in the service of just ends because it's expensive. In this case, I think our letter writer has made a case that, like, the trade-offs are now worth it, and that he is certainly justified in using this form of civil disobedience. For myself, a few weeks back when DC was still in a mask mandate gray area and then a mask habit gray area, I always ask the question, who's going to bear the costs? And if the person bearing the cost is some random person earning minimum wage, making me my coffee, who has been charged with becoming an agent of the state, my solidarity is with that person. And so I don't want to make their life bad. But in the case where, the people bearing the costs of my civil disobedience are me and agents of the state, let's go.
I think the last time the only time I've worn a mask on the subway here, which is legally required still, as far as I know, is when my wife is next to me and give me a super dirty look. Nick, do you consider your rampant illegal drug taking as an act of civil disobedience?
I consider that an act of sacred religion, Matt. So, the big thing about civil disobedience, and the letter writer gets to it, is that the function of civil disobedience is not necessarily to get away with something. It is to force the state actors to push, to enforce laws that are bankrupt or that are wrong. And he's ready to bear the cost. I think it's good. The only bit of advice I would give him in this particular case is to make sure that if he does it and he gets fined or he gets arrested or whatever, that he publicize it, because the point of it is to, both make the people who are enforcing an unjust or stupid law feel bad, to force them to confront what they're doing. But it is also, it's a way of changing public attitudes about things. But I think that's part of, what gets lost in a lot of civil disobedience kind of discourse and glomming on, and this includes mass protests. People are like, oh, fuck, I got arrested. I shouldn't be arrested for breaking the law. And it's like the way that civil disobedience works most powerfully is by forcing the people who are hauling away civil rights protesters, or, it could be anti-nuke people, it could be whatever, or in a more serious, like profound way in Germany, where there were acts in Nazi Germany, where there were acts of public civil disobedience, to kill people for really fucked up ideals. So more kudos to the letter writer, and I hope it works out well for him.
Well, I agree. And also kudos to Catherine mentioned Russians. One of the latest protests I've seen them do is to walk in the middle of of what's it called? Red Square, Kremlin, whatever. Moscow there. They got there with a communist holding up non-existent signs. Like, it's not even, sometimes they would hold up signs that with like a thing that Vladimir Putin had said. And they're like agreeing with it because it was semi-peaceful and they would get arrested. Now they're not even holding up signs. They're pretending to hold up signs and they're getting carted away. What's your name? Peter? Beardy, the drink guy. Do you like Martin
Beardy,
Luther King?
Beardy, Mick Drinkerson? Tipsy McStagger?
You could do that all day and I'm going to laugh at everyone. Do you believe like Martin Luther King believed that you have a moral duty to disobey unjust laws?
A moral duty to? I mean, maybe in some cases, but probably not in every single one of them. I would just say, you know, to the letter writer, consider whether this is the most effective way to achieve your desired ends. I don't know enough about German politics or German media to have like a strong opinion about this. But sometimes protest can be an effective way to galvanize public support against bad laws. But sometimes more conventional process oriented, you know, sort of like go see your local council member, lobby the mayor kind of things are actually going to be more effective. And I don't know what the answer is in this case, but consider like, what end are you trying to achieve? And if the end is, I want the mask laws changed, is this actually likely? Do you have can you make a case to yourself and to an independent person that this is the most effective way to go about achieving those ends?
I think a street theater mat of The Sound of Music, but transformed into an anti-mask allegory. People love Captain Von Trapp and those kids. Auf Wiedersehen. Good night to masks. Come on.
Captain Von Trapp have violated the mask mandate is a real question for our age.
Oh, yeah. Now, come on. You see that? There's the popular gif of him ripping the Nazi flag.
Yeah, they make the mask out of the curtains, though, so all the kids would have matching
ones. Aren't there exceptions in most city mask mandates, or at least there were, for like traveling entertainers, right? So if you show up from another town and want to sing,
that's a good point. Yeah.
You're automatically exempt from the mask mandate.
Sure.
Well, let's get Nina Hagen on the next week's episode. Edelweiss, by the way, made up for The Sound of Music in the mid-50s. It is a remarkable Broadway tune, which has now been, it's like General So's Chicken, but for Nazis.
It's like, absolutely.
Yeah. Edelweiss was created out of whole cloth by the, whoever it was, Hammerstein, Rogers and Hammerstein.
I'm still not overlearning that wrote, like the family tartan thing was invented by Scottish and
like 16 minutes ago.
Amazing.
Yeah. Sir Walter Scott, you know, and a bunch of people.
Away from me as well. Fun.
Let me tell you about John Lennon and the way that he treated his
guys,
wife.
Did you know that Irish pubs aren't actually like most Irish pubs?
Okay, Matt, save us from ourselves, please.
That's why they're worth going to.
Importantly, exactly right. Also know that there is the Yvonne Trapp family hotel in New England
Vermont.
Saving us from ourselves.
No.
You're making it
that
worse.
Was like Vermont became a dumping ground for refugees. You know, it's I always hope that Solzhenitsyn ended up like, what is this? You know, these Von Trapp kids, I thought they were dead already. You know,
you imagine Bernie Sanders going to the Von Trapp family.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Hide away singing Edelweiss.
See, this is why we need IP laws. We need copyright to expire on all of this stuff so that we can have a Star Wars movie where Admiral Akbar says, it's a Von Trapp!
Oh, please.
Catherine, you have the blade, right?
Well, Ian is just pumping the gas right now.
I learned the blade, cool. So we'll be okay.
I will just remind listeners that my only two acts of public civil disobedience, organizing them, were extremely on brand and super petty and pointless. One was to oppose a smoking ban at the University of California at Santa Barbara. We let a smoke in. That was fun. And then the other one was to oppose restrictions on street musicians.
I'm so anti-street musician that I like
I know.
I'm struggling with my principles versus my aesthetics.
Yeah, isn't it civil disobedience? I mean, I think Martin Luther King said you have a moral responsibility to hit shitty street musicians.
I remember that quote, yeah.
In a nonviolent way, but, you know, still get your point across. Street music is not the voice of the oppressed.
I was once actually hit by a German on the head while playing street music.
I was a drunk guy,
like on the top of the head, like kabumph. And I accepted the blow just so that I could say the phrase, "Don't hit me, I'm the guitar player," which I thought was hilarious at the time. Yeah, yeah. See, that's what I'm here for. Let's just go straight into, did we start already? What we have been consuming in the cultural sphere, Riss. Peter, do you want to
read? Yeah, I read the novel The Candy House by Jennifer Egan. It is a follow-up, sort of quasi-sequel to her 2010 novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad. And it is similarly pyrotechnic, just in its technique, and absolutely just like deeply enjoyable to read, while also being one of these novels that you look at and you go, good Lord, this is someone who has an incredible command of the craft. So like A Visit from the Goon Squad, every single chapter is structured as... was that a mouth trumpet in the background somewhere?
No, that's an actual...
Okay. Like a Visit from the Goon Squad, every single chapter takes place from a different perspective, from the perspective of a character who had been in a previous chapter, except for obviously the very first chapter. And there are some like gimmick structure chapters. The famous one in A Visit from Goon Squad was that there was a whole chapter structured as a PowerPoint deck and like a series of like a decision tree. In this one, there is a second person spy thriller sequence that takes place a little bit in the future, in which a woman has like a thing implanted in her eye and her ear, and she's like giving instructions to the next set of like spy ladies who have to go on a similar sorts of missions, but she's also talking to herself and narrating the experience. There's also an incredibly complicated email chain chapter that's just an absolute delight. Some of the characters from Visit from the Goon Squad come back, but for the most part, this book is focused on the succeeding generation of characters and the ways their lives intersect with new technology, in particular, a kind of social media that allows you to upload your memories and your consciousness and then share them into the collective. Or if you are someone who finds that idea quite dark and disturbing, become an eluder. And so there's a whole industry for eluders that gets like built up, in which people play... in which you can basically pay somebody to play you online, and then you disappear, and no one knows where the actual you is, even though, like, your children can still text you and get back, like, completely, you know, relevant responses, and, like, you still appear in searches and all that, and yet no one can find the actual you. And so it's this great, just sprawling, crazy, incredibly readable and human and empathetic story about like the way that our lives are entangled in technology and memory and each other. There's also a chapter about a weird guy who takes on an art project that's just, he wants to experience true authenticity in other people. And so he just goes places and begins to scream randomly. And he's like, the moment that people like you, he's like just talks about the discomfort that he sees on people's faces and how much he enjoys it because it's like the only true thing in the world. And it's,
you know,
it's
what this reminds
so
me of?
Strange and so wonderful. And you think about it and you're like, yep, that's right.
A former Reason staffer who shall remain unnamed, but who used to just face the wrong way in elevators, which is just the silent way of doing the same thing.
Wow. Who was that?
Shall remain unnamed.
Can you give initials?
Yeah, sorry.
Was it in the DC office?
Because like,
it's like an elevator
sources,
of two.
Nick.
Is it Mike Lynch? Was it Mike Lynch? I mean, guys, I don't know anybody else on the call even knows who he is.
It's a podcast.
Lanny Friedlander, I'm pretty sure, was kind of kooky in elevators.
I introduced this
I'm
topic.
Guessing he
the Reason's founder.
Them.
Don't make me scream.
Well, you know.
Yeah, it's a shocker that one would appeal to you, Peter. Nick, what did you consume?
I consumed, and I want to get the title correct, Studio 666, which was the movie that the Foo Fighters put out about a month and a half ago, originally in theaters. It's now available on every streaming service. But the context or the setting is that the Foo Fighters have to deliver their 10th album. But they're, Dave Grohl, who is the, you know, the dictator of the band, isn't quite feeling it. And they end up moving into a haunted mansion in Encino, a part of, you know, of L.A. in the valley. And then it just gets grisly and satanic, et cetera. It is a great rock and roll movie that makes fun, first and foremost, of Dave Grohl. Secondly, of the Foo Fighters. Thirdly, of rock music. Fourthly, of horror movies. Fifthly, of movies itself. What I like about it, and it's made a bit tragic because Taylor Hawkins, the drummer of the Foo Fighters, died like about a week or two after this started to be available on streaming services. But so it's a last chance to see him kind of acting. And Pat Smear, who is one of my favorite musicians, the guy who was the guitarist in the Germs originally and then was the touring guitarist for Nirvana and has been in and out of the Foo Fighters for decades now. But it harkens back to a moment when musicians steeped in a DIY culture take the next step and start producing stuff within a corporate context. It's funny. It's weird. It's very violent in a cartoon way. If you like Monty Python, the levels of blood and gore and exposed bone. If you like the Scream franchise, you'll find it pretty enjoyable. But I like that it's being marketed, you know, directly to people as well. So I recommend Studio 666, but not if you believe in backward masking.
The Foo Fighters also and Grohl and company have done great documentary work over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
That's totally worth checking out, both in series.
Yeah, Sonic Highways, as well as Dave Grohl's The Studio City, which is a documentary about a particular studio in North Hollywood, which is just fantastic. So it's, you know, one of the things that I like about Dave Grohl, he can scream. When he screams, people respond in a positive way. But also, he's a real custodian of a genealogy of music, of a particular type of music that is both expansive and inclusive. But he, you know, he's kind of like Allen Ginsberg was in the counterculture. He is a guy who shows up in a lot of different places and knows other people. For reasons that are obscure to me, I caught it's all over YouTube, his elegy for Lemmy of Motorhead.
Oh, it's great.
Is one of the most spectacular pieces of kind of like Maslowian self-actualization, you know, and if you don't know who Lemmy from Motorhead is, and I will remind people that at some point within the past 5 years, we had a Reason style session where we concluded that you no longer have to say Lemmy from Motorhead. You can just identify Lemmy as Lemmy, but he is not the type of person you would identify with being at the very pinnacle of Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. But Dave Grohl does that with aplomb and, you know, just real conviction. Grohl is a great figure because he is a DIY guy. And I think a lot of libertarian temperament is encoded in that kind of
He's script. Also just such a great Studio musical 666. Polymath, right? Yeah. There's this little clip that went around within the last year or so of him describing how he just flatly ripped off the Gap Band, this old like great disco dance band from the 70s, for a lot of the drums in Nirvana's Nevermind, in particular on Smells Like Teen Spirit. And when you see it, fantastic. You realize, holy crap, Nevermind, Smells Like Teen Spirit is built on a backbone of disco drums.
Makes total sense. Catherine.
Yeah, what?
Do we need to revive you? Do we
good.
Get one of those Pulp Fiction shots in the chest to wake you up?
True story. I was not allowed to see Pulp Fiction in the theater when it came out because my parents saw that scene and it freaked them out so much. But yes.
If I may also, that was produced by Miramax, which was owned at the time by Disney. And we can travel back to conservative outrage at Disney for releasing that movie, as well as a bunch of other Miramax movies, such
in
as Priest.
In part because it was a follow-up to Reservoir Dogs, which was the subject of congressional and Senate House hearings. along with Mortal Kombat around that time?
Was that before or after the cloud
Disney,
of dust
Disney
in
goes
Lion
through
King
cycles.
Had the word sex in it? Remember that conspiracy theory?
That's
Disney goes, and you know, also remember in the late 60s, no, but it's just Disney is a flashpoint for, you know, culture wars. People used to talk about how Disney ruined everything in the late 60s. It was mostly from the left. It made everything pretty and perfect, and it papered over the disgusting truth of American culture and exported it elsewhere. There's a whole Latin American critique of Disney and Donald Duck cartoons in particular. And Donald Duck shows up in Horkheimer and Adorno's The Dialect of Enlightenment as the person who takes his beating in cartoons so that workers take it
at
the factory.
Not real.
I mean, Disney is, it's absolutely true. Look it up in the culture industry.
Really
chapter,
think
please,
Matt
sir. And there's
is about
also
to punch all of us in the Pumbaa.
No, I'm.
You know what?
I've since I've graduated to the next
he's
level.
Giddy. He's punchy. Of punchy, not punching at this point.
Catherine, for a change, let's have you talk uninterrupted for
that
more than 10 seconds.
That seems extremely unlikely to occur. I read A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. It came out a few years back, maybe like 2016. I wish that I had read it during peak lockdown, because it's a genuinely beautiful book about a Russian aristocrat who runs afoul of the Soviets and winds up confined to his luxury hotel for the duration, overlooking Red Square, speaking of. And It's a very interesting book because it reads quite light. It's almost sort of like a drawing room kind of. It's very mannered. It's it's very sort of highfalutin, but it's against this very, very dark background. And actually, one of the blurbs is a blurb by Tana French, a podcast favorite recommendation, who says, "It brought home to me how people find ways to be happy, make connections, and make a difference in one another's lives, even in the strangest, saddest, and most restrictive circumstances." And I think, you know, this book has been very, very popular. It's being made into a TV series. And for that reason, my elitist heart is inclined to dismiss it. I actually found that it had a lot of weight, and I picked it up initially thinking, I've been meaning to read this book and it's set in Russia and stuff is happening in Russia, without much more thought to it than that. But really very illuminating and lovely. He is also the author of The Rules of Civility, which is a kind of glittering Manhattan society book glittering Manhattan society people like, but I actually found this one to be better. So A Gentleman in Moscow, if you are interested in gentlemen or Moscow or being locked in your house, which almost all of us
Matt,
are.
Is
oh,
it,
nope, it didn't work. I did not make it through my answer.
You were going on for more than 10 seconds. I'm sorry.
Cross the 10-second rule.
I was just going to say, Matt, this, we've been talking a lot about Moscow and about China or Russia. And I mean, are you in the back of, in the playground of your mind, are you hearing the Scorpions' Winds of Change?
I've never not. No, I'm more of a love at first sting type of person when it comes to the Scorps.
I don't know. They were transformative. They ended the Cold War as much as anyone else.
It was, I don't believe
you want your rock bands like your corporations to just be talking about going out on dates and having sex, not getting into political content.
You missed when you left the party the other night, Nick, at 3 o'clock in the morning.
The party ends when I leave it, Matt, but continue.
A comparison between Randy Newman's Rednecks and Guns N' Roses' One in a Million. I was obviously taking the One in a Million side.
There's no
Anywho,
comparison.
Speaking of
no
books
comparison
about,
whatsoever.
Well, the One in a Million is much better. Speaking of books that have been, you know, I should have read this a long time ago, but now Russia makes me read it.
Please, is it the Bible? Is it the Bible, Matt Welch?
Catherine?
I can't save us.
Can we send in the drone strike that we talked about earlier? No, it's Tony Jutt. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. J-U-D-T. Jutt, thank you.
Jutt. With a J-U-D-T? Jesus.
Melancholy Frankenchrist. He wrote this great book called Post-War that I've been meaning to read forever. Came out in 2005, multiple award winning. It talks about the subhead is A History of Europe Since 1945. That's what it is. It is a great essential reading, particularly for anyone who is likely to use a phrase such as, this is the biggest, worst, etc., fill in the blank since World War II. You go read another book, and the book is post-war because, 1946, 1947, 1948, not big picnics in Europe. There's a absolutely devastated continent. The U.S. was so much more powerful than everybody in the world coming out of that. And the policy choices made, the statecrafts made, the institutions built, the bad choices, the good choices, the horrible settlements of human beings after a war, the ethnic cleansing that happened all over the place in the years after the end of World War II. It's great context for the time we live in now, and etc. It's interesting to read that Judit in the intro talks about the genesis of the book came like right in the middle of November of 1989 when the anti-communist revolutions were taking hold and the Berlin Wall was coming down. He was in Vienna, Austria, and thought to himself, well, all of our like canned takes about how post-war Europe has gone is all going to change because of now. So I better get cracking on that book. The book came out in 2005, came out 16 years later. And it's interesting. That is, in fact, the best part of the book up until 1989. It gets a little bit less interesting afterwards because it's a little bit more difficult to assess. But it's just terrific, very relevant passages about the Red Army, its comparative ways that it occupied and dealt with people, and just the policy outlook and the foreign policy outlook in the world from 1945 to 1957, let's say, because that encompasses a lot of the bad things that happened in 56 in Hungary and the Suez Canal, was just so unimaginably more difficult in many ways than what we're facing now. And it's the bias of recency or whatever that makes us think that we're living in an especially difficult time. Like, nah, dudes, we're not. Really great book. Tony Drew, Post-War.
Matt, I would if you liked it, I would also recommend his 1992 work, Past Imperfect, which is about French intellectuals from the late war period, 1944 to the Hungary invasion, because that really is where Sartre, finally kind of pulled up his pants and, did something. But it's a precursor to the book you're talking about.
Yeah.
And he also has a book called The Burden of Responsibility, which is about the what he would consider, and I think most people from a liberal, true liberal perspective would, the burden of responsibility, people like Raymond Aron and Camus. In the post-war era, he's a fantastic historian of Europe as well of liberalism in its best possible way, and he's what a really fantastic thinker who unfortunately died I think in 2010,
correct,
from cancer.
That's all the post-existentialism we have time for here. Thank you for listening to everything that we do. Go to reason.com/podcast for more. That includes the Soho Forum series, the Gene Epstein, and also the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, which has a recurrent speakeasy series. Nick, we have one coming up. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, next Monday at Caveat Theater, we're going to be talking with Faisal Saeed Al-Matar and Melissa Chen, the founders of Ideas Beyond Borders, a group that is doing fantastic work to bring kind of ideas about pluralism, secularism, critical thinking to the Middle East and beyond. They're also helping to fund girls' schools in the Taliban Afghanistan and helping people get out of the Taliban's Afghanistan. You can go to reason.com/events and see that. The week after that, the Soho Forum, also in Manhattan, is featuring Elizabeth Nolan Brown debating the legalization of sex work. So we've got a couple of great events coming up in the very near future in New York. Go to reason.com/events.
Thank you, Nick. And thanks to everyone for putting up with Nick and me and Peter and Catherine. And we'll see you next Monday. Goodbye.